Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author Nicole Krauss, whose latest collection of short stories is To Be a Man. She's joined in conversation by Greg Chagnon. And now join Greg Chagnon as he introduces Nicole Krauss.
Good evening. I'm Greg Chagnon, writer, reader, teacher, critic, and the former book columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. On behalf of the National JCC Literary Consortium, I'm pleased to welcome you to this very special Book Fest in Your Living Room featuring international bestselling author Nicole Krauss. We'll be discussing her most recent book, the highly acclaimed collection of stories titled To Be a Man. But first, a little about our honored guest. Nicole Krauss's fiction has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's Magazine, Esquire, and three of her stories in this collection, To Be a Man, have been chosen for inclusion in the Best American Short Story series, including Switzerland, the very first story of To Be a Man, which appears in the 2020 edition of this very prestigious anthology. In 2010, Nicole was chosen by The New Yorker for their 20 Under 40 list. Her books, which include her debut novel, Man Walks Into a Room, published in 2002, the absolutely beautiful The History of Love, which was published in 2005, Great House, which was nominated for the National Book Award for Fiction in 2010, and Forest Dark, which came out in 2017. All those novels have been translated into 37 languages, and Nicole is currently the first writer-in-residence at the Zuckerman Mind-Brain Behavior Institute at Columbia University. So please welcome our very special guest, Nicole Krauss. Hey, Nicole.
Hi, thank you.
I had the great pleasure, as you know, 4 years ago when Forest Dark was published, to speak with you in person at the book festival. And I'm so pleased to be back tonight to talk to you about this great new work of yours.
Thank you. I have vivid memories of sitting in the green room with you.
Oh, great. Thank you. That means a lot. I'd love to start tonight with a little sampling of the book and of your work. So I know you've selected a selection from the last story of the collection, which is the To Be a Man story. So please, would you honor us with some of your words?
Sure, of course. So let me set this up a little bit for the audience. I'm choosing the very last section of the very last and title story, To Be a Man. And all you really need to know is that this story is narrated sometimes in first person, sometimes in third person, by a woman who is in her mid-40s. And she's looking back over the many relationships she's had in her life with men. She's thinking about this idea of what it is to be a man. So the first section is about her father. The second section is about a lover of hers who she refers to as the German boxer. The third section is about an Israeli friend of hers called Rafi, who it's really about his marriage and also about his time in the military and something that happens to him in Lebanon. And this final section, which I'm going to read to you, is called Childhood, and it's really about her boys. It's about raising boys. So here we go. My boys are in the back seat, exhausted by the heat and the day-long sun, leaning their heads back and staring with glassy eyes at the passing sea. And either they are driving away from freedom or toward it. After the difficult months of my undoing, months during which they watched over me with worried eyes, wanting to know how I'd slept, how I was feeling, not wanting to leave me, wanting to know whether my struggle would ever pass, they have been restored to their carefree state, midsummer, joyous, watched over. My store of knowledge about them seems to be the closest I've ever come to possessing something infinite, and only a small part of it can find a foothold in language. And that's part of what is asked of us, isn't it? To be a witness, to be able to recount our children's stories from the very beginning, exactly when and where they were conceived, how the older favored the right side of the womb and showed little interest in the left, and punched up against my belly skin from the inside with a knee or fist. How the younger came into the world with a furrowed philosophical look, a slight skepticism almost, but a willingness to be convinced, and a downy fur on his shoulders that later fell out. I've told them the stories of their births many times, but at some point something shifted. They began to insist on making me the hero of these tales rather than them. Now what they want to hear is how hard I needed to work to push them out, how I refused any pain medication because I wanted to be able to stand and walk and writhe, however necessary to help them through the birth passage. They want to hear again how great the pain was which I prevailed over. Can I describe it? To what could it be compared? What they like, it seems to me, is to hear what an act of terrible strength it took to push them into the world, and that I, their mother, was capable of it. Or maybe what they want is to celebrate again the old and fading order of things, where they are not called on to protect, but are themselves watched over and protected. Enormous at birth, both are now so slender that their rib cages are visible under their skin when they lift their shirts over their heads. I know everything about what is visible of their bone structure beneath the skin, and about the skin itself, the precise location of each beauty mark and when it arrived, and the scars and what caused them. I know in what direction the hair on their heads grows and the way they smell at night and in the morning, and all the many faces they went through before the ones they each wear now. Naturally, I do. When the older one worries that he is too thin and weak, I tell him how my brother had been built the same way when he was young, and, without warning, like a storm comes so suddenly that someone somewhere must have prayed for it, a change came over him, that the thinness is in their genes, the sticks for arms and narrow waist and ribs poking out, all of it written into their bodies like an ancient story, but that sooner or later the time will come when the smallness and thinness will be overwritten, subsumed by mass, and the boys they are now will disappear, buried inside the men they will become. Your brother, he asks, trying to imagine it. My brother, who he once, but only once, saw in a moment of fury he failed to contain, pushed me across the room and threatened me with a fist. The small one is still too young to long to fall in love. He is surrounded by love, and that is still enough for him. The older one has already begun to long for it, but his body hasn't yet caught up with him. About this, he can still joke with me. For now, desire and the workings of the body are still subjects for humor. But as the months pass, something has begun to loom behind it, larger and larger. He is waiting for the changes he sees overtaking his friends and worries they will never come to him, that he will never desire the way others do. It's like a switch, friends who have boys tell me. One day it goes on, and after that, things are never the same. The door closes on one side and opens to another, and that's that. Another friend, a man, says that he had been a quiet reader all through childhood, and then between one month and the next, he began to throw chairs. This worries the older one, too, the possibility that he will no longer be who he has always been, that he will lose something of his sensitivity, so valued by everyone who loves him, that he will become capable of violence. When I go to kiss him goodnight, he curls his body into mine, and in a nervous voice tells me that he wants to remain a child, that he doesn't want anything to change. But already he is no longer a child. He is standing out on a bank between the shore and a sea that goes on and on. And the water, as they say, is rising.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Beautifully captures just the mystery of living, of loving. It's beautiful work, Nicole. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to dig first a little further into the title of this collection, To Be a Man. It is this title of this last story, which you've read from. And I know traditionally story collections, you know, the title becomes borrowed from one of the titles of the story. What made you select this title, To Be a Man? Does the title speak to any sort of thematic element that is consistent throughout these stories, or a creative concern of yours that you touch on over and over again?
Well, you know, I suppose it's ironic because 7 of the 10 stories are narrated by women and only 3 by men. But those women are all thinking about, meditating on their relationships with themselves and with their friends, but also their relationships with men. And I think there's probably no woman who hasn't at one point or another, if not every week, if not every day, asked herself the question, what would my life be like if I had been born a man? You know, how much more angry could I be? How much larger could I be? What opportunities might I have had? It's just, it's a question that is nestled inside the question of what kind of woman am I? And I think the same is probably true of men. You know, I mean, not to the same degree, right? Because of different kinds of privileges or what have you. But I do think that question is there. And it's a question that's also there between couples. This is a collection that is very much a meditation on coming together and coming apart. What does it mean to be part of a couple? And what does it mean to long for freedom? And what does it mean to long to be part of the stability of togetherness?
Yeah, freedom. Nicole, you mentioned freedom. And I think for me, reading these stories, I saw you returning to sort of that question throughout the book of, you know, what is freedom? And in this section of the story that you read to me, a man with her friend Rafi, who's been married for 20 some years, and then he and his wife decide to have this open marriage. And it seems like these characters are seeking freedom, but, you know, what is freedom? And you mentioned, you know, the narrator of this story thinking about her friend Rafi and wondering, is freedom from the relationship? Is it freedom from the world in which relationships are, you know, honored and favored? Or is freedom just accepting all that and seeing the, you know, the whatever is in the future for these relationships? So could you speak a little more about, you know, your notion of freedom?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I was just thinking about this today, and I was in conversation with someone, and I asked them if they had ever read a book by the brilliant British psychoanalyst Adam Phillips. He has many wonderful books, but my favorite is called Missing Out. And there's a section in there that describes how the desire to get out of things, to get out of a situation, whatever it may be that we're in, is one of the most powerful driving psychological forces in us. And I thought that was just such a brilliant idea, that we are all, in each in our own way, struggling to get out of something at every moment. That's a basic human urge. And I think that has to do with the fact that every one of us at every moment in our lives is negotiating the where we are, where we fall on the spectrum between the very human desire for stability, for safety, that we have as children. We want to be together. We don't want freedom yet, right? And then we start to taste it for the first time, and we draw back and forth. It's like watching toddlers do this in adolescence. But the thing about being human is also that we are, you know, the only species, I believe, that probably knows that its fate is to evolve. Its fate is to change. And to change, we need freedom from what we are and what we've been and what we're bound to. And so all of us find ourselves in that struggle, again, that toddler, adolescent, you know, midlife and on struggle. Between what is it to belong to something, whether it's a family or a couple or a community, and what is it, how does that liberate us into comfort, into feeling, you know, good, and how does that hinder us and hinder our growth? And so I think, again, we find a lot of the characters in these stories negotiating that question at different times in life.
Mm-hmm. And that story, again, that you read from, you mentioned sometimes that story is in first person, Sometimes that story is in third person. And there are sort of sections of the story. So with one time we have the narrator's relationship with the German boxer and then Rappy. And then there's a mention of her father who was very angry and is no longer angry anymore. And it's almost as if, as I read the story, you as a writer are seeking freedom from narrative conventions, from, you know, widely accepted and long established conventions of storytelling. And that's what I think makes your fiction so exciting. Can you speak about your intention there?
Yeah, I think that desire for freedom is at my own psychological core. I mean, the molten hot core of who I am is that. And I think it's, you know, I'm glad and I'm touched that you feel it in the writing, because I feel it in myself as a restlessness that is not satisfied until I find what feels to me like a novel way of expressing something or making something. And so a lot of the times when I'm most stymied or stuck as a writer is actually when I can't figure that out. I can't find the flexibility I need to do something that feels to me really, really new. And the times that I do find it, often I find it first in structure, because in the complexity of structure, I feel the most access to how meaning is created. So let's say, for example, I were writing a novel or going to write a story, and I wrote it in a very linear fashion with one voice. Let's say a novel, just with one single voice, one narrative perspective from beginning to end. That doesn't give me the same freedom and flexibility as if I add a second voice, and suddenly I have the echoes between those two voices and the underground meanings that are connected. What if I add a third or a fourth, as I did in Great House? And suddenly there are these multidimensional voices that are creating echoes and spaces and mirrors within the narrative. And suddenly meaning has this whole richer possibility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think not only in structure, you're talking about structure, I'm also thinking about where typically a story goes. So for me, one of the most exciting, engaging, fascinating stories in the collection is The Husband. And I don't want to spoil, you know, too much of the plot for readers who are yet to encounter the story. But there's a mystery. And the mystery is, who is this man who's appeared in the lives of these characters? And there's really, the main character is seeking some sort of rational explanation, like who he is, what he's doing, what are his intentions, what are they going to do about it? And there's a point in that story, there's a lot of things that are happening within this family. That character has a great line where she's sort of reconsidering, in a way, her need for explanation. And you write this incredible line, which to me has stayed with me, is, what is the good of expansiveness if one doesn't expand? And that line to me is so provocative. And it's almost as if you're telling us, you know, in terms of fiction, typical fiction with explanations, that this need for explanations, this need for resolution is in a way limiting, moving against the freedom of the form.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing that you said. And I think this practice of existing or sustaining uncertainty, which is really the gift that those of us who practice reading gain. We as readers, I mean, if we're going to read the very best literature written, we must learn to sustain ambiguity and uncertainty. And it's uncomfortable. It really is. We want answers, and we want immediately to know what things mean and why things have happened. But if we don't sit with things, we don't have a chance to understand how these things reflect and echo in ourselves, and we can't come slowly to our own questions. I was about to say conclusions, but I don't know that there are ever conclusions in that space. Our own questions, really.
Right.
You're listening to author Nicole Krauss, whose latest collection of short stories is To Be a Man. She's joined in conversation by Greg Chagnon on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I want to say one more thing about that story, because I had been thinking a lot about strangers. There's another story in the collection called I Am Asleep, But My Heart Is Awake. And it's also about a stranger who shows up in the apartment of a daughter who's inherited her father's apartment in Israel. She didn't know the apartment existed. She doesn't know who the stranger is. The story goes from there. And I think I've always loved the possibility, the potential of what a stranger can deliver, in the same way that I, I love not knowing what's going to happen in a book before I open it. There's that desire to find out and the gift of what might be delivered to us that we can't anticipate. So I've been thinking a lot about how after the Holocaust, after World War II, the Red Cross and all these other groups would often alert people to surviving relatives. You know, you would get a telegram or something that said, your sister's alive, your husband, your brother, your cousin. And people waited for these things. You know, more often than not, they didn't arrive, but sometimes they did. And so this story takes place in Israel, where that was really happening a lot. And now this story is set in the present day. So there's no more of those telegrams, obviously. And yet it's playing on that idea, because someone from the Department of Social Services, although that name gets played on many times in the story, knocks on this elderly woman's door, and her husband has died. And they say, after a lot of to-do, they say, we found him. And there's this little old man in a brown hat. And she says, who? You know, she's so bothered by it. Who have you found? Your husband, your lost husband. And she laughs because she said, I know exactly where my husband is buried, in the cemetery down the street. Like, I don't know who this guy is. And yet the story is told by the narrator is her daughter, her grown daughter. Instead of it being just a funny tale and that's that, and can you believe what happened? And let's forget it. That was a crazy thing. Day by day, week by week goes by and he stays. This husband is not the husband. It never could have been her husband. This Hungarian mathematician stays, and the grown daughter who's talking about her elderly mother is herself divorced and kind of thought she had a pact with her mother. Like, weren't we happy the way we are? Why were you accepting this man? And so it does begin to make her question many things about herself.
I want to ask a question about how your desire to always create something new, to sort of move past neat explanations and move into the honoring the mystery, how that's reflected in the way you create these stories. So, some writers have a blueprint, they have a game plan, they have an outline. Some writers just go into it, I'm just going to discover what I discover. I think I know the answer to this question, but what kind of writer...
No blueprint, no plans, no notes, no nada. And sometimes I really curse myself for working like that. But I'm very improvisatory. I'm very intuitive. I often think about it. When I tell people this, they kind of don't quite believe me. Say, come on, but these stories seem to be structurally, at least, very carefully crafted. How is it that they're improvised? And I say, well, first of all, they're written slowly. So I want to point out that many stories in this book, I wrote the beginnings of, and then I left them for years. I wrote Forest Dark and then came back, my last novel, and then came back and finished them. And so they sit sometimes for a long period and gestate and in my, unconscious, and something happens there and I find my way years later. So that's one thing. The other thing is that, I often think about improvisation in terms of some really great improvisatory art musicians. Keith Jarrett comes to mind, and an amazing piano jazz musician. And he would do these incredible concerts that, they would be pressed into vinyl and CDs, they became like the Colin concert or Vienna concert, that were improvisations that were just incredible. They would bring the audience and him to these amazing heights. They were beautiful. But this is a man who's a virtuoso and since he was eight, had been practicing piano since he was eight. So I haven't been practicing writing since I was eight, but I may be improvising, but I've been doing this a long time, and I have a sense of what works and what doesn't. I have a sense of my own instrument, let's put it that way. And so, but that sense of intuition is absolutely fundamental to me, because otherwise I would have no desire nor need to write these stories. I would have a need to make a living, and I would figure out some easier way to do that. But I want to discover, as much as I assume my readers want to discover something, I want to be transported. I want to know something by the end that I didn't know at the beginning. So if I were just executing something that I already knew, then I think I couldn't imagine what the engine would be for such hard work.
Then what does your revision process look like? I mean, if you are honoring the improvisation, to me, revision sort of means the sort of lack of improvisation and the fixing almost.
Well, I'm working very slowly. So I'm thinking, as I said, I'm rewriting paragraphs, I'm moving forward, but I never know what the end is going to be until I get to the end. And once I've gotten to the end, there may certainly be some small revisions, some tightening, but nothing major. I only ever reach the end at the end. That may be unusual about me. I know that there are writers who know the end or write the end and remove. For me, it's always this building toward that something. You know, the revelations often happen at the end of my stories, and I'm building toward that. And once I have it, it's just polishing after that.
And what about deciding whether a piece will be long form, a novel, or a story? Do you know that when you sit down to write, or does that also decision come through the improvisation?
It comes through writing. Normally what happens is when I have finished a book, there starts a long generative process of trying to find the next one. And so because I have this rather backward way of working, which is not having, you know, a line of novels that I've been thinking about and characters and things sketched out and ready to go, it's just, I have no clue. So I'll write a lot of things. Like right now I'm in this space I'm describing, this kind of between book or at the beginning of a book space. And my home screen is filled with files of voices, characters, stories, the beginnings of things, 4,000 words, 2,000 words, 8,000 words. And at some point, something gels. At some point, a few things, usually it's a constellation of things, come alive in my mind. And I see, oh, this is what won't let me go. I'm thinking about this over and over and different in these different ways. These things are a novel. And these 2,000 words and this, okay, let me start at the beginning. And so then I start with those words and I begin to figure out a structure. But then there's a whole bunch of things that are left. And some of them I never return to because they weren't alive enough and they were, and some of them won't let me go. And those are those ones I come back to and I think, oh, what is this? And usually it's a story. It wasn't something that was imperious enough to demand a novel, but something which was powerful enough that it needed to be finished.
Has fiction been your only form, or what you think in the future will be your form? I mean, in this novel, you have these references to film. So film as art, I'm sure, is an obsession, if you will, of yours. Do you think you're going along these lines of improvisation? Do you think ultimately, or have you experimented with other genres, other forms of art?
So when I was starting, when I was 14 until I started my first novel when I was 25, I wanted to be a poet and I wrote poetry. And I was extremely serious about that. So serious that if you would have told me that I would have like ended up as a novelist, I would have thought that was a tremendous fall from grace, because poetry was like the apex of the language. So fiction, prose was not in my plan. I'm so grateful that I stumbled my way into it. By the way, because I felt I had lost my freedom in the poems, I needed something. I couldn't find something. I made it the poems too small for myself by trying to perfect them. And so I literally, it was like, not literally, figuratively, but, you know, it was like elbow through the window and, you know, kick open the door to make more space. And the novel is just this big, spacious, messy, imperfect thing. So that happened when I was 25, and that became Man Walks Into a Room. And then I really haven't looked back at writing poetry. I don't know. I think that I will always work in a prose form, but I can, and I'm not sure that I can imagine writing. I'm not drawn to writing for film or TV, but I would like to experiment with collaboration. I did a little bit of that with some choreographers. I did some text pieces recently for them, and that was thrilling, just to work in a complete work with people who are working in a different medium and be able to add mine to theirs and layer that. And I've been thinking about working with a musician. I mean, you know, you think about somebody like Laurie Anderson does amazing work with narrative and sound and music. And so I think there are things that I'd like to do to get out of the box of the solitude of writing and the fact that it's one of the few art forms that you can't really collaborate, but you can, you know, there are ways out of it. So.
Well, back to the book, To Be a Man. Several of the stories in the collection you present worlds that are seemingly in danger. At End of Days, which takes place in Southern California, there's the fires are threatening the city. In Future Emergency is a fascinating story taking place after 9/11. There's something in the air in which people are told to put on these gas masks. And the story Amour, which takes place in a sort of a somewhat futuristic world where something has happened either to nature, to the world, people living in refugee camps. What are you up to by placing so many of these stories against impending or existing calamities?
Yeah. Well, you know, these are our days. It's this collection spans 20 years, although most of the stories were written in the last, you know, 3, 4, 5, 8 years. But there, that one, Future Emergencies, was written after 9/11. And it seems prescient now because, you know, we are all walking around with masks on our face. But, you know, that moment, you know, for all of us is a kind of historical turning point. And I think a sense, you know, the sense of danger, you know, that has been added by, you know, climate crisis and the way that that's created, and among other things, a huge refugee crisis. And so all of these things, I think, are not, no longer like imaginary fiction. They're not like, you know, sci-fi. They are the lives that we're living. Who would have guessed when I wrote that story about gas masks that we would all be reading this now and be like, yeah, everyone can't see anyone's face, like all wearing masks, you know, slightly different kind of masks. But again, like, what is in the air? What can we breathe? Which is what that story is about. Can something harm us in that way? And the End Days, which is really about a young woman whose parents have divorced amicably after many years of marriage, and she's left in LA while they've gone off to their lives for the summer. And it's really about who she is and who she's struggling to be. But in the backdrop, there are fires in Los Angeles, and there are always fires in California now. When I first started that story, it was the first time that fires had like jumped into the city line. And, you know, it wasn't the case that there were wildfires in the news with those insane pictures, you know, constantly. And now that is simply a part of our life. But story ends with a meditation on the fact her father is an archaeologist, and he talks about how the fact that we know anything about ancient cities, he's been excavating Megiddo, which is in the north of Israel, you know, for 20 years. And so we have many, many, many layers going back, you know, many, many centuries. The fact that we can, as archaeologists, we can see that is because each city is destroyed by a natural event, a fire or war. And it's because of its destruction that we know something about it, right? And each of these layers of destruction are packed on top of each other. We can date, you know, which way the bricks face because of when they burnt and where their magnetic north was. So many secrets that are there for us to unlock because of destruction. And she's thinking about this as these fires come through. And the question arises, what will be left of us? And what will some future civilization know about us that is kind of burnt into the remains of, you know, where we are? And again, it's an eerie thought. But it's not a thought that's beyond that hasn't happened before in the history of mankind, as this archaeologist tells us. And as we see every day when we're reading the news.
And that young point of view character in that story, End Days, I was fascinated with the actual business that she had to do. She had to deliver the paperwork of her parents' get to the rabbis as a way to close off that relationship, to order it, to close up. And she herself, I think, I was fascinated by the fact that she is reacting against this world in which everything is closed, finished, resolved, order. And she has this great line that I loved where she said, what place did curiosity have in a world like this? And a world like this, I read it as a world in which everything is ordered and resolved. Her father always wanting to get to the bottom of things. Her mother, who is a linguist. Is she a linguist, the mother?
Yes.
Is trying to dissolve the mystery of language. And this young narrator says, there's something amazing about mystery. There's something amazing about the unknowability about, I think, even, you know, tell me if I'm on the wrong path here, of having these fires emerging and threatening the city. There's something that makes that life even more vivid rather than a life full of order and
control. Absolutely. She's also she is the only one in this family of four who seems willing to experience a disorder of the heart, which is the disorder of what happens when a family comes apart. Everyone else is so neat and organized, and it's so amicable, and they've decided all of this, and her older sisters are off at college and with her boyfriend, and so she's left alone, the only one to feel these things. And of course, we know that, you know, the feeling of those things, the grief involved in that is very honest. It's an honest and authentic way to live, and the other way is we call it suppression, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm thinking of the line in the first story, Switzerland, with the main character looking back on her experience as a 13-year-old in Switzerland in a boarding house, and the two older girls who are in the middle of drama, shall I say? Your narrator says about one particular girl, I think that she taught me something that however many times I've forgotten it and remembered it since then has never really left me. Something about the absurdity and also the truth of the dramas we need to feel fully alive.
Yeah.
Beautiful line. As the father of two girls who were once teenagers, I certainly can see the beautiful meaning in those lines. So what is it, why do we feel as human beings to sort of do everything we can to limit the drama in our lives?
Oh, I don't know. You know, look, I don't want to play psychologist here, but I would say that we turn to books not to limit the drama. We turn to books to engage the drama of our lives and to animate the drama we feel in our lives anew, to be honest, I think. You know, those of us who want smooth sailing and not to be moved or bothered or provoked, I don't know that we become readers, we become other things. But, you know, we often, now we think of drama as either theater or the teenage, oh, you know, come on, no more drama. And so we think of it as like we think of it as melodrama. But drama, the high stakes of what happens to us emotionally when we go through the many things we go through in life, that's worth examining. That's worth feeling. And I do think every true reader believes that, feels that.
And is that why you have so many of these relationships in the book? So many people wondering if they should stay or they should go. It's not a problem with the relationship. It's just this desire to actually be, I read it as fully in this relationship. And part of that is always thinking.
I think all of the characters are seeking self-knowledge, right? You know, and so sometimes we stay in relationships because they're comfortable, but we don't have a chance to grow or to better know ourselves or to have a larger swath of life that we can call our own. And I think I tend to gravitate towards characters who feel that longing, who have that longing for some larger life, even if it's painful, even if it comes at a cost. They want to change and grow. Not that they don't regret their decisions sometimes, and not that that isn't hard, but it isn't enough for them, a steady, smaller, safer life.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is author Nicole Krauss, whose latest collection of short stories is To Be a Man. She's joined in conversation by Greg Chagnon. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Before I go to the audience for questions, I have one last thing to ask you because I'm just fascinated with this idea of the Zuckerman Mind Brain Behavior Institute and you having the honor of being the first writer in residence. Can you explain a little bit about that institute and your work with them?
Sure. So Columbia has a really quite extraordinary center that's in a beautiful building designed by Renzo Piano. And the idea... Eric Kandel and Richard Axel, two Nobel Prize winning scientists, sort of had this idea to bring together people, different kinds of scientists who are all working on the brain and the mind. So you have like 60 labs all in this one building, and people are coming at it from different angles, whether it be, you know, molecular biology or genetics or computational stuff. But it's the idea that there can be a cross breeding of knowledge and shared knowledge other than each lab working alone in its dusty corner of the university. And I was lucky enough to be their inaugural writer in residence, which they have an artist and visual artist in residence. So Julie Maritrue is there now, the wonderful sculptor Sarah Zsze is there right before me, and a jazz musician in residence, as a nod to where it is in Harlem. And we, each of us artists, had the privilege of being able to talk endlessly to the neuroscientists about their work and share with them about ours and our creative process. So again, it was more of this crossbreeding of knowledge. And it came in the year, time of the pandemic. So for me, it was this wonderful, even though it was over Zoom and I couldn't be in the building except for the beginning, it was this wonderful way of having like a portal to go through into this other world of neuroscience. And it was a great privilege.
Excellent. Will you continue with them, or is it just a...
It was just a 1 year thing. I would gladly move in. But I don't think the next writer's been announced, but I do know who it is, and it's a wonderful, wonderful writer. And I think that program will go on and on. So I was lucky to be there at the beginning.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You ready to take some questions from our audience?
With pleasure.
Okay. Rachel has a question. She asks, it seems that Israel and Israelis are often featured in your stories. Can you tell us why?
Well, sure. I mean, the book is filled with many places, and I have many places of my life, but Israel is one of the largest outside of New York, which I think of as a country sometimes. I've been going there since I was born, and it's the one geographical constant in my family, where everyone, all four grandparents and both parents, grew up in different countries elsewhere, and everyone met, fell in love, got married, went and made Aliyah to grow old and die in Israel. So it was the place that organized our very disparate lives, and still does. I am there many times a year, as my children now. They come with me, and I am not Israeli. I don't feel that I'm Israeli, and yet I feel it gives me an elsewhere to my here, which as a writer, forget as a person, but that's a whole nother story, but as a writer, gives me enormous richness. There is a liveness there, often a kind of intensity, sometimes a surreality, a colorfulness to the texture of life there that is so vivid and so beautiful to be in and then to write about. And I think I also find it, you know, all my life has been a dream of elsewhere. You know, you can't really be a child of grandparents who came from four different countries in Europe and left because of the war and not wonder what was that elsewhere? Where am I from? You know, where am I going? And that rootless feeling is always a dream of the elsewhere, the other place. And so if I had grown up in Israel, it might not be as strong a subject. I might be, you know, dreaming of Japan or, you know, South America or here. But since Israel is a place that I can, it's an elsewhere that I both visit constantly, so I know it very deeply. It works very well for me. To write about it or set things there.
And that desire for elsewhere, to me, and also the freedom to have different locations resonates beautifully with issues in this book of growth and mystery and freedom beautifully. All right, another question from Eileen. Her reading group was wrestling with the story, "I am asleep, but my heart is awake." And at some point, the group coalesced around the idea that it was all a dream. Were we way off by trying to put it, to explain it that way?
I'll never tell you or any reader that you're way off. I respect how you want and are imagined reading the stories. I do think you're right that that story in particular holds a mystery aloft and doesn't try to resolve it for you. So the question of, is this a soul or is this a real person? Is this, you know, in which realm of reality is the story taking place? It seems firmly rooted in reality. Is he just her father's friend and that's it? He's just weird. He's sleeping a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. Or is this a story about mourning and about grief and the way in which those that we love slowly transform in our lives into other things, into strangers that we imagine we see in the street, or memories that coalesce into something else? I wanted to leave all of that open while still writing a riveting tale.
Another question to Michelle or Rachel. Is it challenging for you to write in so many voices, male, female, and in the past book, Great House, a desk?
Well, I never wrote in the voice of the desk, but the desk was a powerful character in its way. But it's not challenging. It's a pleasure. I love to have more lives than the life that I have. None of us got enough life in this short one. And we all have an enormous amount of language, an enormous amount of imagination and longing. And so that's, again, why we read and why I write, to add more dimension to who I am and my experiences. So if I can't be a man in life, but I can taste or experiment with how it feels to become one in a story, and one maybe unlike one that I would want to be, a tyrannical father like the one in Aaron in Great House, or somebody like Leo Gursky in The History of Love, or Broadman in this collection, The Stories of Sue on the Roof. So I find it deeply pleasurable to bring what I am personally into something else, to become something else.
Great. From Michelle, what writers have influenced you?
Wow, so many. And at different times in my life, different ones in different ways. Sometimes there are writers whose writing on the page will find me at a very particular moment, and that will have a great effect, like Joseph Brodsky, the Russian poet who I met when I was 18 and totally changed my life. Or, W.G. Sebald, who I found, I don't know, a novel or two in. I read his first book, The Immigrants, and that gave me ideas about what could happen in structure. Or the Israeli writer David Grossman, who wrote See Under Love, which structurally is a hugely inventive book. So these writers at different times meant something to me. But then there are writers like Philip Roth, who I was reading since I was 12 and then later met. And, you know, for the last 12 years of his life, I was very close friends with. And that's a person and a writer who had a profound effect on me, not book by book and not page by page only, really, but really as a soul struggling on the page, as a soul that is wrestling with these ideas of freedom and constraint and being part of a community and being free to be an individual. And so there are different things I learned from so many different writers that I had, that I've had my own, I guess, intimate relationship with on the page, and a few that I've been friends in life.
That's great. And clearly you're influenced by other art forms besides writing. You have A Taste of Cherry is in the Seeing Arshadi story, and great French film Amour is part of the story of Amour. What are some other visual artists, filmmakers, that influence you?
I spent a lot of times studying art history as a younger person. I did a master's in Dutch 17th century art, and I wrote about Rembrandt. And I think Rembrandt's self-portraits are some of the most powerful works of art ever created in any form. And I still think about those. And in fact, something I'm writing is still writing about those. I'm still writing about those all these years later. I love, obviously, film. I think there are filmmakers like Krzysztof Kozlowski, who, made films like Three Colors Red. It's part of a trilogy, but Red in particular had a huge effect on me. And that, interestingly, Kozlowski wrote that script, and it was based on a Camus book, The Fall. And that Fall and Red then later influenced Great House. I won't go into that now, but anyone who goes and reads or has read that novel and sees those films and reads will see the connection. Your Honor.
That's great. And a final question from the audience, from M. Levitt. What great books have you read recently and then you could recommend us to read?
Sure. So classic books that I've read recently that I hadn't gotten to until now, amazingly, Elizabeth Hardwick's Sleepless Nights is an extraordinary, completely innovative, beautiful book written in the 70s. I'm now reading Joseph Roth's Radetzky March, which is beautiful too. I can't quite believe that I never read it until now, but and then there's a book by a German writer that I love to recommend. She is going to win the Nobel Prize one day, I'm sure. And I absolutely love her, in life and on the page. And her name is Jenny Erpenbeck. And the book that I would recommend of hers is, Go Went Gone. I won't even say more. Just go get it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Nicole. Such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for the opportunity and your time. And hopefully it'll be like the Olympics. I'll speak to you in another 4 years.
Yeah, yes. That would be wonderful. I look forward to it already.
And good luck to you.
Me.
Absolutely. And good night to you.
Thank you.
Our special thanks to Nicole and to all of you for joining us. More exciting book festival and your living room events ahead. So check your local JCC's websites for the most up-to-date schedule of events. And in the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Take care, everybody.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Nicole Krauss, whose latest collection of short stories is To Be a Man. She was joined in conversation by Greg Chagnon. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio. And the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.